Blog Talk Radio.
The 2014 FIFA World Cup Review Show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another fun-filled day of World Cup action over in Brazil, as this was another fantastic day of World Cup action down in South America. My goodness, what an unbelievable day we've had again here. Fantastic stuff happening down to the wire in this last game with Argentina, Bosnia-Herzegovina, the French showing up big. And, of course, we're going to start it off right away by on that first match, which was, of course, Ecuador against the Swiss of Switzerland. You know, many people, even myself, I have to admit, even myself, questioning the FIFA rankings. We're questioning the FIFA rankings of why are the Swiss in the ranked pot? Why do they get a seed? What is the reason for this? Do they deserve a seed? While I'm still not convinced that they still deserve a seed, I think we could say that there is definitely one foot or at least one arm pointing to, yes, they probably do deserve it. Still, though, it's a situation where we cannot say that maybe they deserve any form of a seed to be in this World Cup. And you know what? I think they made some noise. Obviously, something had to give for them to go in their way. But once again, it's a situation where we have to say it. We need to see more from the Swiss to see if they truly deserve that seeding. And at the time, it looked like it didn't deserve the seeding, because Enner Valencia, with a great header off a corner, that gave Ecuador that 1-0 lead in the first half in the 22nd minute. That's a great header. Great, great header by Enner Valencia, who found a way to get Ecuador on the scoreboard. It was absolutely fantastic. And you know what? It's a situation where you have to say that Ecuador, they had this game under control. They had this game under control. They looked like they were about to go out and do a job to get 3 points here. But, you know, you got to give them credit. You got to give the Swiss credit. Because when they went to their bench, I think their substitutes played a lot better and inspiring their squad a lot better than what we saw at the first half. And it was a substitute in the 47th minute, Memedi, who basically scored the same type of goal that Enner Valencia did in the 47th minute. Great ball from the near corner. Admir Memedi was able to head it in and equalize early in the second half. That was an absolute great piece set up from the Swiss, and off they went. Now, Ecuador kept on playing. Ecuador actually showed a lot. Ecuador kept on fighting. They kept on fighting and fighting and attacking. And as this match was going on, there's a bit of a question mark about basically positioning of a sideline assistant on the far side. And we're talking about a goal that was taken away because apparently – it was offside. And if you took a look on Twitter, and this was from Howler Magazine, because it sounds like the far side assistant was running a bit late. It looks like he was trying to play catch-up. Great shot where the ball was played on the replay, where the ball was played by the Swiss. The attacker was in between two Ecuadorian defenders, and, you know, he's well onside. Well onside. The linesman on the far side fell asleep and raised his flag for offside because he thought he was going to miss something. Look, if you're not sure if it's offside or not, then you basically put your flag down. You keep your flag down. That's what you're supposed to do as a linesman. And this was in the 70th minute. Even I tweeted it. I said offside Swiss, Switzerland, but I thought it was a goal, but the flag went up. And then I said afterwards, after the 73rd minute, on that replay on the offside on Switzerland that wiped out a goal, I think he was on, plus that deflection off the Ecuadorian player from the replay. So basically, again, you have a thing where the goal should have stood because of two things. He was onside, the attacker, and the attacker was able to get the ball because it went off the defender, and he should have at least been allowed to keep the goal. Did not happen, unfortunately. But, you know, these are the questions you have to ask. These are the questions you have to wonder, because it's a situation where, you know, once again, this is the World Cup. You know, you can't make these mistakes. And to be honest with you, I think this mistake wasn't that bad. But it is because it's the World Cup. These mistakes should not be happening. If it's not a World Cup, then, you know, we can still complain about it, but it won't be in the magnitude like it's supposed to be. And then, of course, coming off the bench was Seferovic. You know, he comes in the 75th minute, and then out of nowhere, in second half stoppage time, out of nowhere, he just slices himself inside. And then, bang, 2-1 Switzerland in second-half stoppage time. What looked to be a point for both sides became 3 points for Switzerland and nothing for Ecuador. Ecuador played a hell of a game. They did not give up. They did not assume that they're going to win this. They kept pushing it. They kept playing hard. They kept doing well. They kept on going, and you know what? For goodness sakes, Ecuador deserves – you would have to say they deserve a point. You would have to say that Ecuador deserves a point out of this. They should have gotten something out of this game. But you know what? It didn't happen because Switzerland was very, very tough. Switzerland was very, very determined to make a statement. And you know what? They did. Look, I'll admit, I tweeted something I probably shouldn't have tweeted, but the thing is that everyone was laughing about how Switzerland, you know, how did they deserve their ranking and how did they deserve a seed in the draw? And I think that's more, you know, innocent bystanders in Switzerland than it is with FIFA, because FIFA is the one that gives these seeds. And, you know, that's the big question, you know, is, you know, with what's going on with FIFA right now, with the whole Qatar situation, how more legitimate are they going to be? The bribing scandal, of course, we're going to talk, you know, of course, it's about the workers, these migrant workers that they allow to come into the country, and then they tear up the contract right in front of them, and they say, you know, you're not leaving here unless I say so, and then they leave when they're dead. in the, you know, in the terrible summer heat that's over there in Qatar. And now you're seeing FIFA being questioned because of, you know, certain situations. So we're just going to have to wait and see what's going to happen down the road. Of course, many saying that, you know, FIFA contacted U.S. Soccer to say you're not getting the – you're going to now take over 2022. We're going to take the World Cup away from Qatar. And, of course, U.S. Soccer, right thing to do, says U.S. Soccer has not contacted them. So we'll wait and see, you know, how that's going to play out. But obviously, the other thing that's been, you know, flying around with Qatar is, of course, you know, allowing terrorism to fester in their backyard. And, of course, that question always pops up. And it's a big question because why? Well, it's really simple. It's because after everything that's been happening in this country, and I don't want to mix politics with sports, but everyone knows here what's been going on in the U.S. So we're just going to have to and see what's going to happen when we talk about these sort of things down the road. Right now, we're just going to talk about the World Cup and, you know, a great World Cup it's been so far. Plenty of action, plenty of, I'll say this, since the opening match and since the second game, which involved Mexico and Cameroon, great job by the referees to basically just not allow shenanigans to happen. And you know what? Since then, correct calls have been made. You have to be honest. Calls have been made. It is absolutely fantastic to see what's been happening with these officials. And once again, Mark Geiger did a fantastic job officiating Colombia and Greece. Just an absolutely fantastic job by Geiger. Like I've always said, I always believed in Mark Geiger. I've always said that he is the best referee to come out of U.S. soccer for, you know, a very, very long time. And you know what? Good for him to come out and just do a job brilliantly, absolutely doing a job brilliantly. And you know what? It's just fantastic to watch and see because – these matches have been officiated a lot better. These matches have been basically, they've all been done a lot better. They have. And good on these officials for basically doing a fantastic job running these games up to this point. Up to this point. We don't, you know, we're not looking for anything negative or anything like that. We're not hoping for anything negative. But the truth is they've done a fantastic job. They have. They have done a fantastic job. And I'm very excited and proud that we've gotten great matches to be playing. We've gotten great matches that have been played. It's been fantastic, and you know what? Good on them. Good on these referees calling a fantastic game. It's just been an absolute treat to watch, and now we're seeing the players shine, and that's what it's supposed to be. That's what it's supposed to be about, and you know what? Great job once again, and still, we have great job on one end. We have a fantastic job on the other because joining me now all the way from Paris, France, covering French League on and the national team, not just for French Football Weekly, not just for ESPN FC, for beIN Sports, and for every other outlet that he can get his phone and his keyboard onto, my good friend Jonathan Johnson. Jonathan, this was a great match for France, and I think they showed the character that we all know that they can go out on the pitch with.
Hey there, Daniel. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, they did. It was a really impressive performance. I mean, yeah, people will say it was only Honduras, but, you know, you can only beat the teams that are put in front of you, and France did that on the day. You know, they turned up, played extremely well, and I think the most encouraging thing about it is you've now got a real genuine talent like Karim Benzema finally stepping up to the plate, performing the way that he can do for his club team, Real Madrid, on the international stage. It's something we've never really seen from Benzema before. He's kind of kept this confidence going that he's had since he managed to break that 1,222-minute goal drought back in October of last year. And I think that is probably the best thing to come out of this game, really, for France and for Didier Deschamps. Not only do they win their opening game, which is something they haven't done in their last three World Cup campaigns, they also have a player like Benzema now looking like he's ready to really lead them in the absence of Franck Ribéry.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have to say about Honduras, though, is that while they do have talented players, unfortunately, it's kind of like what I kept saying about last show about Uruguay. They've got fantastic players, but when they're clumsy or when they get frustrated, they make stupid challenges. And you saw it. I saw it. Honduras, absolutely ridiculous on how they were defending and just not really paying attention to the ball. And, you know, they get a man sent off, a double yellow, obviously, for Wilson Palacios. And it was the right call. He barreled into Pogba, and that gave Benzema his opportunity for the first goal of the match.
Yeah, it was a really ill-disciplined performance from Honduras, and I think that'll be their undoing in the group. It's not, like you said, they still have some quality in that team. I mean, yes, you know, on paper, you look at all the teams in that group, and you would say that Honduras are the least talented of all of those teams, but there still is ability in that team. Even with a small bit of ability, you know, getting through out of that group is possible, but I just don't think so with that level of with that lack of discipline that Honduras showed against France. You know, there were horrible challenges flying in all over the pitch throughout the whole game. Palacios just seemed like he was intent on getting himself sent off. It was a really bizarre performance to watch from him. I mean, he didn't even last that whole of the first half. There was that incident with Paul Pogba before the penalty, where Palacios went into Pogba. Pogba then lashed out, and then it seemed like Palacios was stamping on Pogba. So it was a very disappointing performance from Honduras in that respect, because they looked like they could have given France a run for their money. Certainly in the first half, they were goalless right up until the halftime whistle. But once they went down to 10 men, that was the end of the game, really.
Yep, absolutely. Now, just to let you know, Jonathan, before we move on to the next subject, you know, this is CONCACAF. This is what happens when you have to, a European side has to face a CONCACAF side, because, you know, we experience this all the time in the U.S. whenever you play these nations in Central America, in the Caribbean. You know, just a little bit too much on the rough end of tackles and just a little bit too much of the sportsmanship, as we like to call it over here, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that, and I saw a lot of people saying on Twitter, you know, this is something that's very very common in CONCACAF. So yeah, you know, I think it will have taken France by surprise a little bit, but at the same time, you know, I don't think that it's something that they're completely unfamiliar with. I just think there's so many different elements at the moment that France will be battling. Not only is it the climate, which is something completely different to what they're used to, you know, but they're then also coming up against these teams who are, as you said, you know, they're not short of talent, but they're perhaps not as strong as some of the teams that France face in Europe. Yet, you know, they're very, very committed, and, you know, they put in very, very physical performances, and perhaps that took France by surprise a little bit at the beginning of the game.
Jonathan, let me ask you this. Obviously, finally, we get the usage of the goal line technology. Obviously, Benzema, to me, I think, he scored the second goal. It did pinball around off the posts, but still, I felt that was his second goal, and he should have gotten a hat-trick. He really should have gotten a hat-trick. But the goal line technology did show clearly where the first attempt was a no goal, but the second one was completely over the line. What's your opinion about the goal line technology that we are finally seeing what it was really made for?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it was the perfect sort of case in point, really, with regards to the goal line technology. It finally proved that it can work, and it can solve those moments where, you know, you're asking yourself whether it went in, whether it didn't go in, that you need to see a replay. You know, and the fact that the referee is now informed that the ball crossed the line, that it was definitely a goal, justice was served, because there's no way that France should have been disallowed that second goal. Yes, I mean, arguably Karim Benzema does deserve to take it, so that will give him a hat-trick in that game. But I still think that the fact that the goal is allowed to stand, you know, that was enough. That proves that the goal line technology can work. And that it has a place in football at the highest level.
Absolutely. Joining us now is my special co-host, Kartik Krishnar from World Soccer Talk. Kartik, we're talking France taking on Honduras. If you have a question for Jonathan, please go ahead.
Yeah, Jonathan, what's your feeling about how France set up in this match? Obviously, we knew that they were going to go with the midfield trio of Kabay, Matuidi, and Paul Pogba. But the width they got, both from their fullbacks, and Taguchi was fit, which we weren't quite sure about a few days ago, and Evra, in addition to the way they used Griezmann and Valbuena, really, I think, gave Honduras fits. I mean, what do you think about that going forward? Obviously, Switzerland's a massive test, a much tougher test than Honduras, but they're getting a lot of width, and that midfield trio seems to just control the pace of the match in the center of the pitch.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It's a very good point. The midfield trio is absolutely vital to the way that Deschamps likes his France team to play. You know, as you said, they control the pace of the game. And without that midfield three, I think France would struggle to impose themselves as often as they can. Valbuena is also a very important player in that formation. You know, him on that right-hand side, he provides a lot of width there. And then you get him sort of switching over to the left-hand side, and then the player that's on the left, whether it's Griezmann, whether it's Benzema, you know, they come and play on the right for a bit, and that sort of empowers Valbuena and Benzema when he's playing in that role to sort of drift in and out and sort of play behind the striker. Sometimes it's Giroud, and you know, you get France creating a lot of chances that way. But like you said, Debuchy also had a fantastic game against Honduras. Same to for Evra. You know, they provided a lot of width there. And yeah, this is something that is part and parcel of Deschamps' 4-3-3 formation. I think once you realize that it worked against Ukraine in that playoff victory at Stade de France, when they came back from 2-0 down on aggregate to win 3-0 and book their place in Brazil, I think that's when he realized that this was the way that he wanted to take the team forward, that he could get the players in that he wanted in the team and in the squad, and put them out in an 11 that could go and win matches. And I think it's something that we've seen with Paris Saint-Germain in Ligue 1 and also in the Champions League, that this 4-3-3 formation, especially with a player like Matuidi, can really work. And it's it allows France to really express themselves properly and assert their authority in every game. And I think Matuidi, for me, is probably France's key player, because he has everything. He has the good defensive ability. He contributes going forward, and he has such boundless energy. And I think that's what makes the 4-3-3 formation possible for PSG at club level, but is now making it possible for Deschamps at international level as well.
Jonathan, Patrice Evra right now, I mean, to me, it looks like he might be carrying an injury right now. Some rough challenges against Honduras. Have you heard anything from Deschamps that he'll be able to play in the second matchup in the group?
There's been no news about Evra for the moment. I think they're waiting for the injury to subside and then to see, you know, the real extent of it and how badly injured he actually is. But I think that even if Evra was to miss a game in the group stage, whether it's Switzerland next or whether it's Ecuador, I don't think that Deschamps will be too worried. They've got Lucas Digne, of Paris Saint-Germain as the reserve left back, and he's more than capable of stepping in and contributing in that team. We were speaking a couple of minutes ago about how important the fullbacks are in this 4-3-3 formation and getting forward and adding width to the team. You know, Dean is a more attacking player than ever, and he contributes so much more. His crossing is far more precise. He's faster, he's younger, he's more keen, and he gets up and down that left-hand side of the pitch for the full 90 minutes. Efra put in a really committed performance against Honduras, as you said. You know, he had to ride some tough challenges at times, but Dean is one of those players who, you know, really adds something going forward, and he's probably the closest thing that Deschamps has to Debussy, who plays on that right-hand side, but on the left-hand side.
Let me follow up and ask you, this may be just a very generic question, but if Evra is injured, any regrets for Deschamps about Abidal or Gael Clichy, both of whom have significant international pedigree?
That's a good question. I don't think there's any regrets really regarding Abidal. I think it's clear that Abidal's career, certainly at the highest level in my opinion, is now over. I think that counts for club level and international level. He has really dropped off in the last 6 months or so with Monaco. And internationally, he just seemed way out of his depth in that game against Ukraine and Kiev when they lost 2-0. With Clichy, yes, we know that Clichy, you know, is not quite finished at top level yet. Still can arguably offer something for the French national team, but it's a little bit like the situation with Koscielny, people asking why he didn't start in central defence instead of Sarko or Varane, and it's because Deschamps wanted to reward Sarko and Varane for being so reliable for him since he's come in as coach, and Koscielny, although he's had a fantastic season for Arsenal, disappointed Deschamps when they went to Ukraine and lost 2-0. You know, he got sent off, conceded the penalty, and that is one of the things that Deschamps also associates with Clichy. You know, he was part of that team, and it's the same with Nasri as well, and once a player lets Deschamps down, you know, he then has to think twice as to whether he really wants to give them a second chance or not. He gave Nasri a second chance in that game against Ukraine. Nasri failed to take it, and Clichy now will have to wait patiently for his next opportunity and must take it if he's to avoid his international career coming to an end under Deschamps. But will he regret not taking either of them to the tournament? I don't think so. Dean is definitely the future for France in the left-back position, and I think that we will see him starting come the European Championships in 2016.
Jonathan, obviously Franck Ribéry ruled out right now with that back issue. Do you feel that, because now that he's not going to be playing in these group games, and I don't know if he does have the ability to recover from it to go into the knockout stages, do you think the rest of the squad is playing a little bit more confident that they don't have to worry about Ribéry, you know, maybe injuring himself any further than he already is?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ribéry, you know, the fact they left him out of the squad, so there's no chance that he can play any part in this tournament. He's out, and he's not going to be back and available for selection until the European Championship qualifiers. Obviously, I say qualifiers lightly because they don't actually count towards anything. But with Ribéry now completely out of the picture, I think that's allowed France to really focus on themselves. They're in that bubble now where they're just concentrating on keeping this real convivial spirit within the team, and making sure that nobody is potentially causing any problems within the camp, because that's one of the biggest problems that France have had in recent years. When they go to these big international competitions, they're prone to imploding. There's such a volatile mix of egos there. And Deschamps has done really well to select a squad that has a lot of ability and a lot of potential, but also crucially doesn't have the same egos as past French squads have had. And because of that, and the fact that Ribéry is now no longer an issue for these players, they're finally able to concentrate on their football, just getting through the group stage and then seeing how far that they can go.
And looks like that'll be it for you, Jonathan. One more quick question. You're taking on Switzerland in the later on in the week, I believe on Friday. Seeing what they've done with Ecuador, basically coming back from being down a goal, what is your worry about the Swiss, or what have you seen from the Swiss that France can go, you know, stay top of the group and advance?
To be perfectly honest with you, I didn't see anything from Switzerland or from Ecuador in that game earlier today to suggest that either of them are going to pose France any problem. That was before we saw France's performance against Honduras, and that was before Switzerland got the late goal, and neither of those things have changed my mind about it. I don't think that Switzerland will pose France any problems. I think it's quite conceivable that France will have their qualification into the latter stages sewn up by Friday, because I don't see them losing against Switzerland. And if they can get a draw, then that means they just head into the Ecuador game needing possibly a draw. And if they can get the victory, then obviously, you know, they're guaranteed their safe passage through to the latter stages. I don't think that France have anything to fear going to play this Swiss side. They're very talented, don't get me wrong. They've got an excellent coach in Omar Hitzfeld. But I just think that they seem to be lacking something. I believe that it's down to the climate. I don't think Switzerland are handling it well. We saw it in their warm-up games ahead of the tournament. They don't look like they've adapted to the climate in South America. And because of that, I think they'll struggle to put in really high-quality performances, the same high-quality performances that we saw in the qualifiers, you know, when they get to play at home in Europe. And for me, I think that's going to count as a huge factor for France going into this game. And I can only see a French victory at the moment, certainly, if Benzema continues in the same form that he's in at the moment.
All right, Jonathan, thank you very much. I know it's very early in the morning over in Paris, but then again, Paris, just like New York and Miami, the action still goes on, doesn't matter how late it is.
Indeed. Thanks for having me on, guys. Brilliant to talk.
No problem at all, and we'll have you back on later in the week.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks.
All right. That's Jonathan Johnson, of course, writes for ESPN FC. Be in Sports, French Football Weekly with Andrew Gibney, and many other handles. Kartik Krishnar joining me. Kartik, you know, I know you've been busy with World Soccer Talk. Obviously, everything is flying all over the place. Just to get your opinion about so far, what do you think this World Cup has been so far, probably since the disaster with both Brazil, Croatia, and Mexico, Cameroon, with all those goals being either disallowed incorrectly or penalties not truly being awarded?
I think the World Cup has been very good since that point. Mexico won against Cameroon, so that was the right result. However, they should have won 3-0 or more. So, right, so that was left a sour taste in people's mouth. The Brazil game most certainly did. Croatia, as we talked about on the opening night, certainly deserved something from the match, if not a point, maybe 3 points. But since then, the World Cup has been very good. I think people were captivated by the way the Dutch played. And then we had the same sensation in Euro 2008 when the Dutch just ripped through the group stage, and then they ran into Russia in the quarterfinals and were shockingly beat. So I'm not jumping necessarily on the bandwagon that the Dutch are the favorites now, although some people are saying that. It's just we have a history of Holland. Same thing in Euro 2000, just ripping through the tournament. World Cup 98 also, ripping through the tournament until they got to the big team in the semifinals or the quarterfinals. In 98, it was Brazil.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
I agree with you.
Yep. Yeah, and in 2000, it was Italy who they lost to in the Euro 2000 semifinals when they missed two penalties in regular
right.
time. And then, of course, a lost on penalty kicks in after the match remained level. So the Dutch, though, captivated us. I think yesterday was very good. Costa Rica, that was a score one for CONCACAF for our region here. That was a great victory as a CONCACAF person, as an American fan, to kind of validate our region and to and plus that I love this Ticos team. We've talked about them before during the qualifying. Love a lot
mm-hmm.
of the players in that team. Joel Campbell,
mm-hmm.
I think, is going to emerge as one of the stars of this World Cup. England-Italy was a good game. Both teams played well. Italy's just a little bit better, but those were two good games. I mean, two good teams. I think we've seen good games to this point. I think the
yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Daniel. for Ottmar Hitzfeld's team. And maybe it's, as he said just a moment ago, the weather, the heat, they haven't acclimated. They were very poor. They somehow got 3 points at the end there. But I have a lot of respect for Hitzfeld, followed him into Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich. He's a top manager. They have top players in this side. I really have fancied Switzerland to make a deep run in this World Cup. I thought they might hold off France and win this group and get to the quarterfinals or the semifinals. But after watching that match today, I'm not sure. They'll probably get out of the group, but that might be it.
Yeah, probably. I'll say this. I think it goes to show you, I think the starting 11, when they started this match against Ecuador, they just were not adapting to the elements at all. And both goals were scored by substitutes off the bench. So I think if that's what Switzerland's going to have to take to convert chances to have those subs to come off the bench and score, then that's the only way they're going to get out of the group stage, in my opinion, because I will agree with you and I'll agree with Jonathan. Switzerland did not look like they were adapting to their elements.
Yeah, and I think it's unfortunate, because this is going to be a big factor in this World Cup for European nations, is who adopts better than others. England yesterday, I think maybe it was a little naive. I wasn't able to join you for the review show yesterday because of World Soccer Talk commitment.
Of course.
Late at night, which I regret. But I mean, just a quick word on that. England was so good for 25 minutes, but it was as if they were thinking they were playing at the pace you play at in the Premier League, which is you go all out, because it's never that hot when you play Premier League games. It's sometimes damp, it's rainy, it's kind of misty. You genuinely have more energy in that climate. The British maritime climate. So they were, for 25 minutes, England was all over the place. I mean, they were running, Raheem Sterling, Welbeck, they looked fantastic. In this kind of climate, Sturridge looked fantastic, yeah. And those three guys especially. But in this kind of climate, you can't – yeah, I mean, we've seen it with Major League Soccer and the NASL, and, you know, when you play through the summer, you kind of have to slow it down. I know that's not what fans want to see. But I think that's what got England eventually, is that they got to 60 minutes and they were out of gas because they had played so hard. And Italy conserved their energy better. So that's, for the European countries, this is going to be a key. And, you know, we'll see how it affects Portugal. Portugal comes from kind of a maritime climate also. They're playing Germany tomorrow, and then they play the United States. I mean, we're very hopeful that the U.S. can push on and do well in this in this competition, and that might be the game which dictates how well we do, because, you know, my sense is that Portugal is a real question mark coming into this World Cup. They could be very good. They have a lot of good players in their side. They might not be very good. So climate, I think, is a big factor. We saw it with Switzerland today, and they're going to have to do something. Hitzfeld's going to have to do something in the next few days to acclimate for the France game next Saturday, I believe it is. Friday or Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Friday. It's going to be on this
Friday.
Yep,
yeah.
It's coming Friday. You know, I agree with you, Kardik. I think it's all about adapting to what the climate is down in South America, because I'm telling you right now, the big question now is, you know, will Portugal be able to survive? Forget about the scoring, you know, if they're going to survive against Germany on the field. It's also the climate of Brazil that you're going to have to worry about. But, you know, let's talk about Argentina and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Because even though Argentina got a gift because it was an own goal that started the match in the third minute, let me ask you this. Do you think that Argentina started off a little bit more defensive than what we are normally seeing from an Argentinian side that has so many great attacking players like Messi?
Yeah, I think that they were much more defensive than they were with the 5-3-2.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. No, that's okay. Don't worry about it. No, I understand. Don't worry about it. But let me ask you this, though. I mean, finally, you know, I know Messi scored it back in the 06 World Cup for Argentina now over in Germany, but still, though, Messi wasn't Messi till all of a sudden it's like, you know, he goes and becomes this fantastic goal scorer for Barcelona, and everyone all over the world, not just in Argentina, but, you know, not just in Barcelona, but also in the U.S., outside of the U.S., outside of Spain, you know, It just looks like whenever he's in the World Cup, he's got this giant weight on his back. And it's like he's carrying everyone who's a fan of his, maybe not even a fan of his, but at least that enjoys to watch him play football. It just, to me, it just seems like he's got something on his back. It's like something's always on his mind. And finally, he's able to play the game he's supposed to be playing or how he plays it, and he scores a great goal.
Yeah. I don't know. I just don't know how to describe his movement. I think part of what happened in this match, though, Daniel, quite frankly, was that there was a tactical change at halftime, which I'll drop Messi a little deeper into the midfield. Maxi Rodriguez came out. Gonzalo Higuain came on, pairing him with Kun Aguero up front. So you had him withdrawn into a position where he would see more of the ball. Now, getting back to what you were saying about the defensive thing, sorry, we just had a little issue at World Soccer Talk. My editing
No worries. Of course.
That basically the thing that was said that you mentioned about the defensive shape of Argentina, they came out very defensively knowing that Bosnia scores a lot of goals. Ivicevic, who was, of course, an American product, you know, grew up in St. Louis, went to SLU for a year before signing in Germany. He's a player. He didn't start. So I think Argentina was expecting Bosnia to go with two strikers, Pjanic, who is one of the best, one of the most magical players in Serie A, on the ball right behind Dzeko and Ivicevic, and Misimovic would be playing off him. Because Ivicevic didn't start, they didn't need to be so defensive. But as it turns out, they scored that goal, very fortunately, unfortunate own goal for Bosnia. And then it seemed like the Bosnians really controlled play for the rest of the first half. They were very good, and Argentina was just hanging on. Romero had to make some dramatic saves. So there are issues with the whole setup of the 5-3-2, because what it was doing is it was inviting pressure, especially when they were up a goal. So you make the change. Bosnia still kind of controls a lot of the flow of the game, but you've got Messi in midfield, and he can spring that counterattack. And when he's running alongside the likes of Higuain and Kun Aguero, I mean, just think about the number of goals scored in Europe this season in three different leagues, at Napoli, Higuain, Messi at Barca, Aguero at Man City. You know, you've got just all this goal-scoring pedigree, and Argentina were always going to get another one, and Messi got that brilliant goal. So many Messi fans around the world, here in the United States, one of the most popular athletes here in the States. I believe he's the most popular non-American athlete in the United States.
Yeah, he really is.
I saw an ESPN survey over the summer, and Taylor Twellman was real excited about it because, you know, you see that everyone knocks soccer and everything, and ESPN asked people between the ages of 18 and 35 who their favorite professional athlete was. And the expectation was it was going to be all, you know, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, some football player. I'm not that well-versed in the NFL. Also named someone, Drew Brees or someone, Andrew Luck. You know, it was going to be all those kinds of guys.
Peyton Manning,
Peyton Manning, right, of course. Mm-hmm. Messi ended up, like, fifth on the list. So Twellman, of course, exploited him and said, you know, this tells you a lot. This tells you that a lot of the colleagues, his colleagues in the media, his colleagues in that building in Bristol may not want to acknowledge it, but, you know, there's just a lot of people who are soccer fans in this country. And even if they're not soccer fans regularly, they know who Messi is. They know how brilliant he is. So I think it was important for us in this country to see him score that goal on primetime television in the United States. Now, I was hoping Bosnia would get a result in this game personally, but you can't take it away from Messi, and I think it's important as we grow the sport in this country that you build around superstars. He is the superstar. For some reason, Cristiano doesn't have the same cachet in the United States. I think it's because Messi is short. He's kind of an underdog guy. He's a very, you know, good person, good personality. Alexi Lalas talked about on the broadcast today how, you know, that's part of why he'll never be bigger than Maradona in Argentina, because Maradona is this controversial personality, whereas Messi's really a good guy. Well, I think in the United States, we take to those kinds of guys, maybe more than they do in Argentina. And, of course, the other issue with Messi in Argentina is that he basically grew up in Catalonia. He grew up in Barcelona. So, but I think for us here in the States, I mean, I don't want to just play the American angle of this goal, but I thought it was great. I mean, I'm hoping to continue to grow the sport in this country that Messi has a big World Cup. The more Messi does, the more it's on SportsCenter. The more it's on SportsCenter, the more mainstream fans are talking about it. There are very few guys who can transition that. And it's transition that gap, and he is he's the guy.
He is. He's the guy, and you know what? You know, I this is what I always say, Kartik. The dinosaurs in this country, in the mainstream sports media, they will never ever. Unless it's the World Cup itself, and then that's the end of it. Oh, sure, the national team's playing these qualifiers, but does it go any further out than that? No, that's the end of it. So, you know, these dinosaurs, though I like to call them, the mainstream sports media, these editors, sports editors, they think that, you know, it's always going to be about baseball, it's always going to be about the NFL, the NBA,
right.
And, you know, and that's fine. And that's fine, but you know what? It's time to start giving the sport a chance to truly grow. And if you allow it to grow, it's not that it's going to overtake the others. We'll be hand in hand with them. That's the
right.
That's the idea.
Well, it's a lot of people who are involved in baseball that are most threatened by this sport. You see it from the hostility from baseball people on television. You see it from baseball people in newsrooms. I think this is the thing now. They're up against an unstoppable force. This game is growing more and more popular in this country. The demographics are changing. Guys like Messi captivate the American audience. You know, they captivate lay fans. You know, you see Messi. What he does is magical. You don't have that many figures in American sports that just take your mouth away like that. I mean, LeBron James is one, obviously, and I think he had Kobe Bryant at one time and Michael Jordan and guys like that. In the NFL, you've had quarterbacks, Brett Favre, Peyton Manning, that have been like that, or maybe there's great running backs. Over the great running backs don't necessarily get the kind of credit or ability that they deserve. I mean, you know, Curtis Martin, I thought, was one of the best running backs of mine. Generation watching NFL football. He never got really the credit he deserved with the Patriots.
That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah,
that's right.
I mean, I think it's just there's a superhuman element to Messi, which gives us a chance to really push this sport forward. So I think there's a lot of hostility towards him in particular, and that's why it was pretty important while these baseball dinosaurs, some of the guys at the New York papers that you read and the Boston papers and the D.C. papers, fight the sport and fight the World Cup and talk about how un-American it is, that Messi take the audience's breath away and do what he did tonight. And ESPN was great. I mean, ESPN had it up on social media right away. They clipped it. They had it out. Basically, I was on Twitter within 5 minutes. ESPN, if you live in the United States, because, of course, there are territorial rights associated with this, click on this highlight. And I'm sure it's going to be all over SportsCenter tonight. And there's how many guys who can do that? I mean, Messi, and there are other guys who can do it, but no one does it as regularly as Messi. Dribbles through 5 or 6 guys, you know, has a slight vision of goal, puts it on target, slides it in far post. I mean, that's brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. Great job, as always. ESPN always does a great job covering the World Cup, especially, you know, I wish I was in Brazil right now just to be on that set at the Copacabana. I'm telling you right now, I'm jealous, very jealous. Right along the beach. Oh, my God, what I would love to sit in that, probably that wonderfully air-conditioned studio on the beach of the Copacabana down in Brazil. But, Kartik, you know, we got to preview some games here, obviously. USA, Ghana, there's been, I wouldn't say there's mudslinging, but at least there's been a good respect between both the U.S. and the Ghanaian players. Of course, Asamoah Gyan has said, you know, that he thinks that the U.S. is looking for revenge. The players have said, we're not looking for revenge. We're looking to do well and play a very important opponent. So I think it's been a good, healthy respect from both sides right now before this big matchup happens at 6 o'clock tomorrow night on ESPN?
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I talked about this throughout the qualifying. Obviously, I was regularly on your show during qualifying. I think the United States tends to at times historically play to the levels of their opponents. And this is a bit of a problem under Bradley and Arena, playing down to the level of your opponent. I think under Klinsmann, you're seeing a side that plays better against weaker opponents but then has trouble with stronger opponents. Ghana is a team that I don't think they're as strong as they were 4 years ago. Kevin Prince-Boateng was coming off a great year with Portsmouth at that point. Essien was dropped from the team, but he was, you know, he's not really back at full fitness. He's never really been back at full fitness since 2010. Sumi Montari was in a much better place as a player. He was a Champions League winner at that point. Although I have to say, Asamoah had a very good year for Juventus, and he could be an X factor. He wasn't even on the scene in 2010. So, there is a lot of respect with Ghana, and I think Ghana is a very strong team. You know, I go back and forth in my mind. I was saying initially I thought Portugal was very strong, and I'm beginning to think now Ghana might be stronger than Portugal. Maybe a point tomorrow does it. Get a point tomorrow, get three against Portugal, and then maybe Germany's got six, and they're happy to not play with as much urgency, and we get a point, and we get 5 points, we get out of the group. We're going to have to get the 5 points to ensure our passage. 4 points may or may not do it. I think tomorrow for the United States, you're going to see probably Bedoya start over Zusi. This is just my hunch in that diamond. And I think the reason you're going to see Alejandro Bedoya is because his defensive work rate is much better than Zusi's. His positioning sense also. But Zusi gives you an explosiveness going forward that I think, first match of the World Cup, maybe Klinsmann is a little more tentative. He's a little more conservative. Or maybe he goes like Hodgson did for England. I mean, England, we talked about how they ran out of energy. But England went with a very attacking formation. I mean, England essentially started with four guys who were strikers. He played three of them in kind of artificial midfield positions. But, you know, essentially four attacking players to start the game. I mean, Sturridge was the out-and-out striker, but Rooney and Welbeck never are strikers for Manchester United. Sterling, in Rodgers' system, played a lot of kind of left or right attacking positions during the run-in for Liverpool as they were chasing the Premier League title. So, I don't think Klinsmann's going to do that. He might go with that kind of formation. But I'm thinking he's going to stick with this diamond, which is pretty conservative. And in that diamond, you're going to go with Bedoya over Zusi. You're going to go with Beckerman and Jones and Bradley as your midfield. Keep it kind of compact. Rely on Fabian Johnson and DeMarcus Beasley to give you your width. Josie up top. You know, and you just hope Clint Dempsey turns up. I assume he will, but something's already great with him because he's don't know. I guess he's going to be the captain. We talked months ago about maybe
he's the captain.
Thought months ago we might see the captaincy stripped from him and given to Beasley or given to Howard, the two veterans on this team. We knew Donovan was in trouble and might not be on the team, and in fact he's since been cut. But he's going to be the captain, so he's got a responsibility. He's got a responsibility to turn up and lead. And that's something that still concerns me about the United States, is whether Clint Dempsey can be a leader and can be mature.
I think Clinton's going to get the maturity out of Dempsey. That's my opinion. I'm not saying he disrespected Bob Bradley or Bruce Arena or anything like that, but I think Clinton's going to definitely get a lot of maturity out of Dempsey right now, and I think that's the one thing that's been missing out of Clint's play. Even though he has done well with Seattle this season in MLS, that's the one thing I think we're going to see out of him. I think from Klinsmann, because he's finally, you know, look, not to say that what Bruce Arena did was, you know, nothing to sneeze at, but, you know, Klinsmann won a World Cup. Klinsmann is this big figure that the U.S. probably hasn't had. Who knows? Maybe since the 1950 World Cup, where they beat England 1-0 in Belo Horizonte, when they had a former England coach being their coach for that World Cup. So, I mean, that's all I can say. That's all I can see, probably.
Yeah, we'll see. I think it might be smart to just be conservative tomorrow. But then again, now that I think about what the manager said, what Jurgen Klinsmann said coming in, he thinks we need 3 points against Ghana. So maybe he's going to be aggressive, and we just certainly hope that our central defense partnership with Jeff Cameron and Matt Beasler are up to the task, because Gian has been scoring a goal a game in whatever Middle Eastern country he's playing in. He left Sunderland in order to make more money. A lot of people in Ghana are very angry about that because they don't think he's playing at a high level. He left the Premier League club to go play in the Middle East in the middle of his when he's in his 20s. You don't do that, even though they were offering him more money. So a lot of people in Ghana are not comfortable with Gian's move, and he's now been in wherever, Qatar or United Arab Emirates or wherever he is, Kuwait, someplace like that, for the last 2 years. And he scored like 90 goals in 70 league games, which shows you the level of competition there. I don't know if he's going to be as sharp as he was 4 years ago. I don't know if he's going to be as sharp as he was even in the Cup of African Nations in 2012, 2011, when he was still playing for Sunderland. So irony is his moving from Sunderland is part of the reason they went and bought Jozy Altidore over a year later. But that's something where he may not provide the challenge for the U.S. central defense that on paper he should. So, maybe there's some possibilities here. So this is going to be an interesting one. The United States is going to be an interesting team because I think what we know about the United States is in Michael Bradley and Jermaine Jones, you have two guys that potentially can control the midfield in the right circumstances. But then the rest of the team is so much in flux. You start any good team, you want to start with your spine, and you want to start with two really good central midfielders, and you want to have a good goalkeeper. You want to have good central defense. The central defense of the United States is shaky, but you have two really good central midfielders in Jones and Bradley. And Klinsmann knows that, which is why he's essentially altered this formation completely to fit the skill set of those two players, and particularly Michael Bradley. I mean, Klinsmann has changed his entire system and his entire philosophy around one player. But then that also tells you about the weakness of the United States otherwise. And I think that that's important to note, that he's felt like he's had to change his system so that Michael Bradley is on the ball as much as possible. And that tells you that there are no other playmakers in this team. There are not other guys who can do dynamic things. I know people will argue, well, if you had taken Landon Donovan, it would be different. You wouldn't be so reliant on Michael Bradley. Whatever. Klinsmann made the decision. Mm-hmm. He's building the team around Bradley, and that's that. And so we're just going to have to ride it out with this formation and with a team where Michael Bradley's right in the center of the pitch and the play is going through him. Landon Donovan's not on this team. We don't need to talk about that anymore. And again, Donovan, he might have been selfish. Maybe he didn't want to split the glory with Bradley. So I don't know. But that's the team now. Diamond has been designed to showcase Bradley. And then on the other side, I think Asamoah and Prince Boateng are going to be the key guys. Kevin Prince Boateng had a good season at Schalke, and obviously, as I mentioned earlier, Asamoah was fantastic with the Juventus this season.
Yeah, he really, really was, and we're going to see what's going to happen. Here's the schedule for tomorrow, everyone, to watch your games. Portugal versus Germany will be the first match, 11:30 on the pregame, around 12 noon. Big, big, big game, Portugal and the Germans. That's going to be exciting. Nigeria and Iran, we know what we've seen with Nigeria. Obviously, it looks like they've got some flux in this match or in their group. Iran, we don't know what's going to happen with Iran.
Yeah,
obviously, that's going to be a big question.
Let me just interject this real quick, and I know we got to run. Carlos Queiroz, former Red Bulls coach or former Metro Stars coach, is managing them. They've got Dan Gaspar, who's an American, as an assistant. They've got, obviously, an American player who's now with Vancouver, who came up through San Jose's system. So,
that's right,
international. Yeah. So I know we have this political thing with Iran, and I don't like Iran politically. I'm kind of a hardliner on that issue. But from a football standpoint, I'm supporting them tomorrow. I'd like to see them do well with all this American and MLS ties. Gaspar, as I said, he's an American. He's a Connecticut guy. He's the assistant. Kirosh met him at the Metro Stars and brought him over.
Right. Absolutely. No, I absolutely. Look, you know, politically wise, you know what? It's bleh. But, you know, on a sporting Beta Shore you're talking about, though. Beta Shore.
Yeah.
That's the one who's who's with the Iranian national team.
Yeah,
we wish him the best of luck, obviously. We wish Beta Shore the best of luck. And don't forget, everyone, real fast, USA, Ghana, 5:30 pregame, 6 o'clock, the opening whistle. Join Carter Kirshner and me as well tomorrow again, as we'll have postgame on USA, Ghana, and then we're going to talk Nigeria, Iran. And then, of course, we'll have Eric Krekauer from Soccerly and, of course, football.com as he covers Portugal when they take on the Germans. Carter, talk to you tomorrow. Thank you, everyone, for listening tonight.
Thank you.
Enjoy your football. And let's talk some more World Cup tomorrow. Bye-bye, everybody.